Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR in Boston and NPR, I'm Linda Wertheimer, and this is On Point. Say the word gentrification, there's a good chance you'll set off an argument. For many people, it means the well-to-do take over a low-income neighborhood and force out the people who built a community there. But the full story of gentrification is complicated, and making it work better for everyone is even more complicated. This hour, On Point, America's Gentrification Battles. You can join us on air or online. Have you been on either side of a fight over gentrification? What is happening where you live? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Facebook and Twitter at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Washington is Idris Kaloun. He is a U.S. policy correspondent for The Economist magazine, and he has been reporting on the issue of gentrification for months, and he's found a lot of upsides. His recent story called In Praise of Gentrification, and you can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. Idris, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me on.
Now, first of all, let me ask you this. My idea of gentrification is that richer people move into poorer neighborhoods and poorer people get squeezed out. But what you are suggesting is that poorer neighborhoods are becoming richer for these movers in, which sounds like a very good thing.
Yeah. There were three reasons I wrote this story, three misperceptions about gentrification that I wanted to correct. The first is the notion that this phenomenon is widespread, and it's not. It's concentrated in a handful of extraordinarily successful cities like New York, Washington, D.C., Chicago, and San Francisco. Really, most neighborhoods that were poor decades ago remain so today. That's a crisis that receives much less attention than gentrification. But to get to your point, the second is the notion that gentrification harms the poor, chiefly by displacing them through higher rents. And the support for this commonly held idea is not really strong at all in the academic literature. Several studies have shown that gentrification actually boosts the chances that poor people will remain in these neighborhoods that are gentrifying, in part because they're becoming nicer places to live. And the third misperception that I wanted to correct was the complete discounting of the benefits of gentrification, that adding people and wealth into a neighborhood which has historically been poor could well be called revitalization.
Well, now, there are sort of two versions of two ways of looking at displacement, which I thought were interesting. Mm-hmm. One of them would be that as you pointed out, you said this is a misperception that poor people are displaced by wealthier people moving in. True to some extent, but not completely true, I take it. But the thing is that you're talking about this sort of statistically, and I think that it makes a lot of sense. But most other people are thinking about it emotionally. And they're thinking about a person who is out of their house or a place that used to be a multifamily residence divided up house now becomes undivided. And four wealthy people, double income, two kids, have moved into it. That's the vision, I think, that we have of displacement.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we are seeing that side of it, and that's important. But there are other sides that we're not seeing. So what we're not talking about is that in gentrifying neighborhoods, there's a reduction in crime. So this is a study from economists at MIT who saw that when Cambridge, Massachusetts gentrified because of a change in rent control policy, crime went down. Schools become better. You know, we know. So one of the people that I interviewed for my stories was a man who bought a house in Logan Circle in Washington, D.C. in 1993 when it wasn't a place he really wanted to be. He bought it for $130,000. And he just sold it for $1.6 million. So we're missing those factions of people. We are also, I think, possibly overlooking the benefits that come to living in a neighborhood that is higher income because there has been a wealth of economic and sociological studies that look at the effects of people living in concentrated poverty. Gentrification is a process that reverses that. And so while I can't use statistics to argue against this feeling. I think that people need to work together and come together, and there's going to be friction when neighborhoods change. But I think that's also that's also a blessing, because that is how people come to be closer together in the cities and in our democracy broadly.
Now, here's something that I wonder about. I also live in Washington, D.C., as you do. And one of the things that is interesting to me is that when I moved into Georgetown, which was many years ago, one of the things I noticed was that the predominantly black churches were still there. The black people were not still there, but the churches were still there. I think this is what is, isn't this what is called cultural displacement, that people are separated from their institutions?
So there are a couple of different ways of looking at it. One is that neighborhoods are going to change regardless. So you have this situation of black churches. There's actually a really recent study of Philadelphia that looks at how black churches have been able to adapt to changing neighborhood populations. They change from time to time. What you see on the other side is you see historically white neighborhoods that have not been willing to accept new housing and new change. And so I think that that is also a problem. Right, people, I think, need to be more accommodating towards change in their neighborhoods, and that's going to involve some friction, as I've said before. But the point that I really want to stress is that the idea that poor people are being forced out because of gentrification is not one that's supported by the academic literature on this.
I was also fascinated to discover in reading up on this subject that there are. That gentrification is not purely a rich or poor question. It's not necessarily motivated by differences in wealth. It's very much geographically forced. I guess San Francisco would be a good example of that. If you are living somewhere near the water, and you are poor people, and in a community that is largely poor, there is not much land in San Francisco, and everybody wants to live on that land, and they really want to live on land that looks at water. So those people take over that land. That geography and the presence of a river, the presence of an ocean, even the presence of a mountain in some places like the Arizona cities makes a big difference where there is no room to move.
So there's actually a lot of room in San Francisco. And this, I think, gets to a point where people have misplaced the blame for housing affordability, which is a crisis right now in American cities. They place that blame on gentrification rather than restrictive supply, which is the big issue with San Francisco, where 80% of the city is zoned so that they can only accommodate single-family homes. I mean, the big issue there is you have local planning, you have NIMBYs who don't want higher density.
Not in my neighborhood, you don't, right?
Yes, yes, exactly. And that forces up housing for everyone. And so the point that I make about gentrification not being linked to displacement, you know, if we decompress that, one of the reasons is that for poor people in America generally, they're paying much more of their income than they were before towards rent, regardless of which neighborhood they live in. And they're at a very high risk of eviction, no matter what neighborhood they live in. And so we need to be focusing more on how to help the poor, regardless of which neighborhood they live in, on how to undo the growing problem of people living in concentrated poverty. The number of people who are living in those neighborhoods of concentrated poverty has doubled since 2000. That's a much, much bigger issue than neighborhoods that were once poor getting richer.
It's interesting to think about some neighborhoods where you have homes in which people have lived for many years, but for the most part, you make the point that in poor neighborhoods there is always gentrification or not gentrification. There is always a lot of flux in those neighborhoods. People move in, people move out because people are kind of on the edge of being poorer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think I think that's exactly right. The people who so stridently oppose gentrification, I think, risk self-contradiction because they're the kinds of people who bemoan white flight from city centers, who bemoan racial segregation in American cities and increasing class segregation in American cities, and they're absolutely right to. But how else are those trends going to be reversed except by poor neighborhoods becoming better off, except for historically minority neighborhoods becoming more diverse? That process, by the way, is what gentrification is, and arguing against it, arguing for a blanket ban against neighborhoods changing, is uncomfortably like arguing that poor neighborhoods should remain poor, that historically minority neighborhoods that are often black should remain segregated and cloistered off. And I think that's wrong.
Now, you make a big point that when cities are considering gentrification and are considering kind of planning and trying to figure out what is the right thing to do, you are arguing for a nuanced approach. Could you explain that?
Yeah. As I said before, there are benefits that come to children who live in neighborhoods that are high opportunity. There is a mountain of economic literature from Raj Chetty at Stanford University, from Robert Sampson at Harvard University, showing the benefits that come to children from living in better neighborhoods with access to better schools. And we know this from experiments where we give people housing vouchers and see them moving. So gentrification, meaning places becoming better off, I think is something that we should think of as good. And it also depends on which place we're talking about, right? So if you go through Detroit, downtown is bustling where it wasn't before. But there are people who will wear shirts that say, "Don't Brooklyn my Detroit." And that's curious because Detroit is a city that's one-third of its previous population maximum. The median income is just above the federal poverty line. In truth, Detroit could use a bit more Brooklyn in it. So I think that gentrification has become a pejorative. If you are on the liberal team, it's something that you instinctively think is wrong. But I think that we're missing all of the benefits that come from neighborhood revitalization, from the channeling of funds and people into these neighborhoods that have been historically disinvested in. And by the way, we're doing it through market mechanisms, which isn't a good in itself, but keep in mind that the federal government, especially as currently constituted, is not going to be doing that anytime soon.
Thank you very much for this. Idris Kalun is U.S. policy correspondent for The Economist magazine, and he joined us from Washington. This was terrific. Thank you.
Thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
When we come back, we talk to two experts who've thought long and hard about what gentrification can mean for a neighborhood. Are you one of the newcomers in your neighborhood? Have you been welcomed? I'm Linda Wertheimer, and this is On Point.
Planet Money tip number 17. A great analogy doesn't have to make sense.
Busier than a one-legged bobcat covering up his own crap on a frozen pond.
Didn't you just make that up?
Well, yeah. Just...
Planet Money, a poetic podcast about the economy.
This is On Point. I'm Linda Wertheimer. We're talking about gentrification this hour. You can join the conversation. Is there a way to make it work for everyone? Did you come out a winner or a loser when your neighborhood changed? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Newark, New Jersey, is Lance Freeman. He's a professor in the urban planning program. Wait a minute. Let me go back. I've got too many plannings in this list. In the urban planning program at Columbia University, he's the author of There Goes the Hood, Views of Gentrification from the Ground Up. Lance, it's great to have you.
Thanks for having me, Linda.
Now, I understand that the Economist reporter we just spoke to made liberal use of your research. Is that correct?
That's true.
So I want to ask you about that. But first, I want to ask you, if you would just tell us, what do you think gentrification is? I mean, what does the word mean? What is the term?
Yeah, I try to define it in a relatively neutral way. So I see gentrification as a process when you have a neighborhood that at one point was relatively poor, relatively low income, had experienced disinvestment. There was not much in the way of commercial investment there. And then the process is whereby people of higher income, perhaps higher educational attainment, start to move into the neighborhood. And as well, you start to see more investment, maybe more retail shops opening, things like that.
But you have also raised the idea in some of the things you've written that somehow, even looking at what you just said as a potential benefit, that jobs are coming into the neighborhood, that there are grocery stores where there weren't grocery stores before, that the neighborhood may be safer, more interesting, that schools may be improved, all those kinds of things that you believe are in part the product of gentrification. You raise the idea that gentrification feels bad for some people. Even maybe irrationally, they feel bad.
Yeah, I think people feel bad for a number of reasons. So first, is the one that was discussed a little bit with your previous guest. You know, housing prices do tend to rise. That makes it harder for low-income folks to afford to be able to stay in the neighborhood or to continue to be in the neighborhood. So I think that's one that's well known. Second, too, is, when we think about a neighborhood, it's a community, right? And with gentrification, it's oftentimes being driven either by public policy or market forces, right? And so, we use the market where we allow the market to allocate a lot of things. Clothing, for example. I'm sitting here in a blue shirt. If the price of blue shirts go up and I can no longer afford it, I could buy a different color shirt. And, it's not necessarily a big deal. When neighborhoods change, though, right? And so housing becomes more expensive and people cannot afford it. Now we're talking about something that we feel somewhat have mixed feelings about allowing the market to dictate, right? Because it's reallocating housing to people who can afford it. But it's also taking away community from people. And community, those are relationships. Those are social institutions. And, I think we're, for good reasons, we're much less comfortable with allowing the market to dictate that. And then, the other thing, too, with the influx of newcomers, influx of people of higher socioeconomic status, perhaps higher educational attainment, you have different people. Sometimes they have a different way of doing things, a different way, different culture, if you will. Okay. And so how does a community decide what's acceptable, right? In many communities, it's done, if you have a homeowners association, for example, it's done formally, but perhaps it's done informally. Neighbors gossip or whatever. They talk to each other. But, when you introduce people who come in, have a different background, they're not really socially connected with the people who are there, how are different views about how to resolve conflict addressed? Perhaps too often they rely on the police. Okay, so if there's a conflict about, for example, how loud should the music be played or, where to cook out.
Right,
instead of people, talking to each other, maybe gossiping, which is another set of issues. But that's the way community norms are set. People talk to each other, maybe talk about the kids. They pull the children aside. But with newcomers coming in, I think too often because there's not those social connections there, perhaps because they're from different backgrounds, people then are resorting to perhaps formal mechanisms such as the police, right? And that's on the side of the gentrifiers. People who have been living in the community for a while, they might also be upset with things that the newcomers are doing. But again, they don't have the social connection with these individuals. So that just leads to frustration. And there's really not a good mechanism for addressing the fact that the newcomers are allowing their dogs to run around off the leash or whatever, stereotypical gentrifiers typically do.
Okay. Now, we're going to hear from Roxbury, Massachusetts. Doug is calling in. Hello, Doug. I think perhaps we lost Doug. Is that correct? So let's skip over that and over Doug and go to Faye, who is calling us from Portland, Maine. Hello, Faye.
Hi, Linda. How are you today?
Pretty good. Go ahead and tell us what you called about.
Sure. So I am from Portland, Maine. I have had to move out of Portland, Maine because I can no longer afford it. I live 20 minutes out. I had to purchase a home, and my mortgage payment is less expensive than the cheapest rent we could find. There have been a lot of issues that we've had in our city, being unsure how to make policies, how to ensure that there's affordable housing. Right now, we're in a position where there's a lot of squeeze on land on the peninsula, which is, the walkable part of the city that people want to live on. So they've been moving a lot of services out, like the DHS department, And right now they're working on moving the Oxford homeless shelter out, 15 minutes out on Brighton Avenue. And it's an issue because a lot of those resources that were centrally located for a lot of these individuals are going to be spread out. And it's, already causing a lot of problems. But it's just crazy to have seen the city change in, the last 6 years. And it doesn't make any sense to me.
Thanks very much for that. Now joining us from Berwyn, Pennsylvania, is Susan Wachter. She's a professor of real estate and finance at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School and the co-director of the Penn Institute for Urban Research, which focuses on sustainable urban growth and outreach. Susan, welcome back to On Point. Thank you very much for doing this.
My pleasure.
Now, let me just ask you, in a sort of pro-con way, what do you think about gentrification? Is it if you can remove individuals and their upset from the equation? Do the cons outweigh the pros, or the pros outweigh the cons?
Well, I think the first bottom line point is that there are pros, which we've heard, but there are cons, which we have not heard. And the cons are not just irrational; they're not just people's feelings. It's hard economics. And the hard economics we just heard from Faye. Faye is not in Seattle, San Francisco, Washington, Boston, New York. She's in a second-tier city, Portland, which is suffering from loss of affordable homes. In Philadelphia, which is perhaps surprising, as Philadelphia is known for its affordable housing, a study by the Philadelphia Fed has pointed to a severe loss of affordable housing in gentrifying neighborhoods. So where The Economist, if I may say so, which, is an interesting article, but where it fails on this very important issue is it speaks about displacement of particular poor families. But we, more generally, as economists, point to the decline, displacement, if you will, of rental units, affordable rental units, the destruction of affordable rental units for the poor and actually for moderate income households as well. And that is an outcome of gentrification.
This is an interesting question to think that in Portland, as I gather, that geography was one of the things that sort of pushed the gentrification process along, because the land close to the water, land in on a narrow peninsula that Portland is on, is in demand. And so
geography is absolutely right on. And it's geography that's not just endemic if you're, on a coast, which of course is true of places like San Francisco, Seattle, New York, which are confined. But cities have boundaries politically by their nature. And cities are have economic benefits that are central, and central conceptually, but also in the center of the city. The big shift in America today is the move back to cities on the part of young people, college-educated people who are coming back for the job opportunities. And the job opportunities increasingly are in cities, but not if you can't access housing.
One of the things I've been fascinated I've just wondered about for a long time is all of the young people who are moving back into cities like Washington, D.C. One of the things that is happening there is that a lot of housing for these young people is being built on land that didn't have anything on it, like railroad yards or big crossway where highways are crossing. Land that was perhaps not as precious as some other land might have been.
That's true. That's happening. And at the same time, there is the filtering down process, which led to affordable housing, is ended. We have a reverse of that. Housing is filtering up. Housing is being improved. This is not a bad thing. It is revitalization. But it inevitably, the other side of it means that there is less affordable housing. The new housing that's going up, which is important because it does increase supply, except if it's in places like flood zones, it's a whole other story. Let's leave that aside. But the new housing that's going up is not for the poor unless it's explicitly, it's not for moderate income generally. It's for the wealthy because newly built tends to be for upper income households.
Lance and Susan, I want to play some sound from architect and urbanist Liz Ogbu. Let's listen to a bit of what she had to say in a 2017 TED Talk.
Poor people don't hate gentrification. They just hate that they really get to hang around long enough to enjoy its benefits. Why is it that we treat cultural erasure and economic displacement as inevitable?
Is Liz Ogbu right that gentrification does not have to mean what she calls cultural erasure? Susan, what do you think?
Culture erasure sounds strong. I think there is a shift that goes on, but I do think that the benefit of gentrification, which is revitalization, bringing back tax dollars, tax revenues to the city, can lead to, hopefully, to shared prosperity, to reinvestment in disinvested social infrastructure, like libraries, like parks, that all have access. And that's important. So from that sense, it's perhaps potentially, if done right, if done with intention, can lead to increased interaction and increased social civility across ethnic and racial groups. It's not impossible, but it certainly needs to be attended to. It will not happen simply by market forces.
Patrick is calling us from New Orleans, Louisiana. Patrick, hello.
Hi, Linda. And this is a perfect segue for what I wanted to talk about, which is exactly what Maria just described. In New Orleans, we've had such a tremendous amount of events, economic and disasters that have resulted in a really interesting phenomenon of gentrification. My family and I moved to an area of the city that 10 years ago was one of the most dangerous blocks and one of the most dangerous cities in the country. There were no less than 2 homicides in the last decade. The house that I currently live in used to be a crack house, of which there were 2 on my block. And today, it's multi-ethnic, multi-income, very, very, I would say, very close-knit community where there wasn't one before. I live next door to government-subsidized housing on one side and across the street from a million-dollar home. And so I think that phenomenon absolutely does happen. People who move to my part of the city move there not to be among their peers, but to be part of a culture, the culture of uptown New Orleans, which is very unique and very rich. If I wanted to live among, you know, white guys like me, I wouldn't be living there. So absolutely does happen, and it's something that I think we can celebrate within the context of gentrification and not overlook where it goes wrong, but really kind of highlight where it can actually happen in a very, very positive way.
Well, thank you very much for that. Lance, in your experience, does this happen often?
Yeah, it's a good question. It does happen, and definitely there are incidences where it does happen. I think what you need, as the caller pointed out, you definitely need some type of policy mechanism to keep housing affordable for people with relatively low and moderate incomes. So there is a need for public policy to provide more affordable housing. It could be done in the form of inclusionary zoning, for example, whereby new development has to include a certain proportion to be affordable for low and moderate income households. It could be done through community land trust, whereby a local community-based organization can acquire land in the neighborhood before the land becomes too expensive, and then use that to leverage further affordable housing development. There's been a recent study done in Texas showing that community land trusts can be an effective antidote to rising housing prices in the face of gentrification. And then also importantly, you need strong community organizations that can articulate the interests and needs of people who have been living in the community for a long time. As Susan suggested, the market itself won't necessarily speak to the needs or interests of people who are relatively low income or poor. So you need some community organizing, some community mobilization, so those people don't feel disempowered and disenfranchised by the process of gentrification.
Thank you very much for that. Lance and Susan, would you stick with us? We're looking at what is gained and what is lost when a neighborhood becomes gentrified. When we come back, we'll talk with a community activist from the San Francisco Bay Area, which, of course, has seen huge, huge challenges with gentrification. And you can join the conversation. Can there ever be a kind of kumbaya gentrification, one that brings together races and classes to create a new and better community? We just heard about that in New Orleans. I'm Linda Wertheimer, and this is On Point.
This is Peter Sagal. When we began Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, we dreamed that our rude jokes would be, in the end, the appropriate way to talk about the news. And look, it happened. Listen to Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me on the NPR One app or wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Linda Wertheimer. We're talking about the process of gentrification. Have you ever seen it work right? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. We've heard from a lot of people from around the country. One of the interesting things is the number of people we're hearing from who are sort of in the middle of gentrification happening. In some cases, they are the gentrifiers. In some cases, they're not. Let's listen to Kathleen. She's calling from Dayton, Ohio.
Hi, Linda.
Hi.
I go back and forth from Boulder, Colorado to Dayton, Ohio, where I take care of my 90-year-old mother. Anyway, I grew up here in Dayton. There's two neighborhoods I walk around, and I love seeing what's going on. East Dayton on 5th Street, there's called Fifth Street Pub. On one side of 5th Street are all the gentrified homes, and I've talked to some of the people sitting in this incredibly great pub. It's a co-op, but they look like they're upper middle class people. I talked to one gentleman who said that people in that neighborhood are sometimes three generations deep. It's a white neighborhood, or had been a poor, working, white neighborhood. Now, on the other side of Fifth Street are houses in dilapidated conditions, maybe every fourth house somebody's living in. And again, I'm wondering about those three generations of families, if they're given an opportunity for low-interest loans and tax freezes. And the other thing I've noticed about Dayton is there are no swimming pools in the inner city for these kids, which there used to be. There in Kettering and Centerville and all the surrounding suburbs, there are swimming pools for kids. Here's my other neighborhood, Boulder, Colorado. On one side of Lee Hill,
I think we're going to Kathleen, I'm going to have to leave you with just one example, I'm afraid. Dayton, Ohio. And bring back Lance Freeman, who is a professor of urban planning at Columbia University, and Susan Wachter, who is co-director of the Penn Institute for Urban Research and a professor at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School. And a new voice into the conversation, Maria Poblet, joins us from Berkeley, California. She spent years as a community activist in Oakland. She was the executive director of the nonprofit Just Cause, also known as Causa Justa. Today, she is a commissioner on the rent board in the neighboring town of Berkeley. Maria, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
What do you think about this question of gentrification? I gather that you have been confronting it on and off throughout your career.
It's a great moment in our history that we're debating this at the national scale, because what has happened in the neighborhoods that I've been organizing in is that we saw this coming a long time ago. Particularly black communities experienced gentrification before anybody else did, and now everybody else is. So the question is, what can we learn from those canaries in the coal mine, and what does it mean for our political future? One thing that has been missing from this dialogue so far is the question of political power. Gentrification isn't some natural rising tide that lifts all boats. It's not inevitable. It's as man-made of a disaster as climate change. And just like climate change, it has solutions. They're not simple. They're not overnight. And we all have to collaborate on them. But they exist. And these communities that have suffered the worst also have created really cooperative, creative, long-term solutions with a long-term perspective. Because what we're debating on a moral, ethical, and political level is housing just a commodity that to be sold to the highest bidder? And when markets balloon, maybe it'll be entirely out of reach for most people. Or is it a human right? And is our government responsible for protecting the most vulnerable communities? And are those communities communities that have a voice in the political process and that have a vision about where it should go? And having worked alongside those communities all these years, I can tell you their vision is beautiful and it's the world I want to live in.
Let's take a moment to listen to another caller. This is Gloria, who is calling from New Orleans. Second call we've had from New Orleans today. Gloria, hello.
Hi, Linda. Thank you for taking my call. I have just a couple of comments and maybe questions. I listened to one of your callers, and he talked about all of the advantages of gentrification, but nothing was said about what happens to those people who are displaced by gentrification. Where do they go? And are we just creating a new poverty area, so all of like rolling the poverty areas from one place in the city to another place in the city? The other thing is he talked about all of the advantages that could be gained through gentrification. Is there another way that the same advantages could be in that area without displacing people? One of the other callers from New Orleans talked about the Uptown area, and I have personal ties with that area in that in the 70s, somewhere mid to late 70s, I had an uncle who lived in the Uptown area, and that was one of the first areas where I saw people coming in a rental property, because many of the people who lived in that area, they rented from someone who may not have even lived in the state, but bought it, redid it as a single family home. He moved someplace else. They bought that. He moved someplace else. And every time he moved, it took something out of him. So my concern is what happened to, one, the displaced people, and two, where are they going? And
okay,
are just creating another poverty area?
Well, thank you, Gloria. Thank you very much, Gloria. Let's return to one of our experts, Lance Freeman. What is there an answer to her question? Can you get the benefits of gentrification without actually displacing people?
I think you can. I think, you know, there are mechanisms, policies that can be adopted, right? I mentioned them previously. For example, if new development is going to occur in a neighborhood that's gentrifying, we can ask that the developers set aside a portion of the units to be affordable to low-income households in the neighborhood. And we could even go a step further and say we're going to give a preference to people who live in the community to have a chance to move into these new affordable units. We can try to invest in schools and job training and other things in the community to help people who are there to be able to take advantage of new opportunities that might be arising in those communities. We could set property taxes to the increase in property values in the community and say, you know what, we're going to take the increment in property taxes that arise from gentrification and plow that back into the community to support affordable housing and other services in that neighborhood. We can also support community-based organizations, right? Community activists and
okay.
the like. They're a crucial ingredient to make sure that people who live in the community feel like they have a voice in what's happening to their community.
Let me just go back to Susan Rochter for a second. Susan, you are you're a co-director of the Penn Institute for Urban Research. Have you ever seen a situation like the one we just heard described, where the community is, where money is being plowed back into the community, where people who lived in the neighborhood's rights are safeguarded? It seems to me that in the kind of the real estate market that I know, people want to be making money. They don't want to necessarily be making nice.
Individuals want to make money. Nothing wrong with that. Governments need to, and often, it's not always negative. Local governments often respond to the community needs. Right here in Philadelphia, we have a project called Rebuild, which is plowing those new dollars that are coming in through the, through gentrification, through higher values, back to the neighborhood. It can happen. We need more examples of where and when and how it can happen. The wonderful thing about these rebuild through revitalization for all, shared prosperity for all, is it truly is for all, and then it does end in the potential, the possibility of communities that are mixed and civil. You know, Elijah Anderson speaks about cosmopolitan canopies in Philadelphia. We have the Reading Terminal. Cities are, by their nature, where people of all sorts come together. But again, we need local governments to respond, and there are local governments who are responding. I can give you other examples, not just my home base, Philadelphia, but there are others.
Maria Poblet, what do you think? Is it, have you seen much of this kind of attempt to mollify the original owners of the homes to deal with people who feel that they're losing something?
Absolutely. What I've seen is the heroism of people who are losing everything, and at the same time, they're trying to create solutions for everybody else. A great honor of mine was to work with Paula Beal, a longtime West Oakland community leader, African-American grandma, who often gave the mayor a piece of her mind. She started the first community garden in West Oakland. And while she was in hospice and while her family was living in a car, she fought for the largest expansion of tenant protections that Oakland had seen in a decade, which was the foundation for now what is a state proposition, the Affordable Housing Act, that would allow cities and counties to implement the strongest rent control possible. And some people in her family said, well, you're sick, you have cancer, you need to meditate and take your medicine and look at the ocean. And she said, I want to leave something behind for other people. I don't want this to happen to anybody else. That generosity of spirit at the grassroots can change our cities, can change our country. And that's what we need to invest in. The idea that you just have to accept displacement when you have development is a complete lack of imagination.
Perhaps
who we are as a country is at stake. It's a huge possibility for us to come together and create a collective story. Where do we want to be in 10, 20 years? Let's not be ahistorical. If you think about where we came from and where we're going, there's a lot more that you can do. What's often unsaid in this debate is that the people who are hit the hardest are seniors. And then
right.
The argument, well, you just need to get used to change, reduces their political voice to basically their age. Why would we do that to people?
Well, now let me ask you something. You're talking about seniors and how they are affected. But one of the things that very frequently happens and that communities talk about is that there are a lot of young people moving into these neighborhoods because they are affordable, because they're close to the center and people can get to their jobs. What I would call yuppies, right? I mean, you see a Whole Foods move in. Can yuppies be far behind?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, they're called gentros here. That's a shorthand for gentrifiers or newcomers. But I think people are more than their role in the economy. Everybody is. And the question is, can we build the kind of relationships that allow us to be more than how much rent we pay or where we shop? And that depends on how much power the people at the bottom have. Causa Justa built over time. There are multiple organizations here in the Bay Area trying to address this crisis, which is enormous because of our proximity to Silicon Valley and the power politically and economically that comes from there and reshapes our neighborhood. Well, where's the power at the grassroots from the people who have a long-term vision about housing as a human right? The more power people like Paula Beal have, the more the kid on a fixie bike can be part of a solution that is good for them in their future.
And presumably get to know the people who lived there before.
Yeah, I mean, the diversity that drew people to Oakland is the same social fabric that's being destroyed by the process of them coming. Nobody makes that individual decision. I'm going to come destroy the social fabric, right? But that's part of the dynamic they're part of. So the question is, do you get to know your neighbors? Do you find out what's happening in your neighborhood? What role can you play? Not everybody plays the same role.
Susan Wachter, let me bring you back in. Do you think that there's a real appetite for this kind of sort of diversification, of the sort of generosity that Maria Pobla is talking about?
I do think there's that appetite. It's a collective appetite, harder to fill collective needs than individual needs. But I do think we have exemplars across the country, not just in low income, but, you know, it's in the interest of higher income areas that are getting even less affordable to bring in folks who will be teachers, who will be able to be first responders. This is America's problem, and there are solutions.
What do you think, Lance? Do you, as an economist, you obviously think in terms of the sort of larger numbers of people. You don't necessarily think of the little old lady in her bed at the hospice trying to make something happen. But what do you think? Is this something that you can imagine in this economy that people would see as the right way to go?
Well, let me correct you. I'm actually not an economist. I'm an urban planner. And I am concerned about little old ladies. but yeah, I do think so. I'm going to be optimistic, just like your other two guests. I do think that collectively, you know, people, this is how social movements start. You know, people become dissatisfied with the status quo, and they grapple and search around for solutions, some of which we've mentioned and have been alluded to on this show. And then it becomes a movement that changes the way things are done. And hopefully, you know, it will become a norm to think about, you know, gentrification occurring, but occurring in a way that helps people that currently live in the community and allows them to prosper and feel like they are part of the process, and that it's not something that's being imposed on them from the outside.
Lance Freeman, thank you very much. He is a professor in urban planning at Columbia University. Thanks for your time. And Susan Wachter, co-director of the Penn Institute for Urban Research, very glad to have you with us. Thank you.
Thank you.
And finally, Maria Pobla, commissioner on the Berkeley Rent Board. It was great talking with you. Thank you.
Thank you.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Linda Wertheimer, and this is On Point.